Welcome to the 23rd episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. I'm the co-founder of Reckless Dice and your host, Jesse Gitzman-Burke. Co-hosting with me is our lich-like troubadour, Lester Crowe, and his strolling bones. And our special guest, Jordan Bloody Sunboy Steelman.
Hello.
Greetings.
So, Bloody Sunboy, what's, I naturally gravitate towards the Bloody Sun orcs. Is that where you're going with that?
Yeah, actually, it's not really any more complicated than that. I very, very briefly played the Warhammer Online MMO, mm-hmm. and I just caught, I think it was maybe even on the wiki that I saw the Bloody Sunboy reference from the game, and I like the greenskins, I like the orcs, so I said, hey, that sounds fun.
Oh, excellent. I mean, Lester has a one-man band that he names himself after.
Yeah, my one-man band. No, I like orcs too, but I still think the Skaven take the cake for the bad guy creatures. Anyway, we've got some news to get to here. And first thing we're going to talk about is the new announcement for Heroes Call, which I think personally was really well-timed. I'm looking forward to this.
I think in the last episode, we covered the basics of what Heroes Call is going to have. But in the meantime, we had their first kind of specific content update where they actually kind of went into some of the rules and features that we're going to get to see in it.
Yeah. It looks awesome.
So yeah, I was excited to see that.
Basically what they talk about is epic monsters are basically the epicness that this is supposed to encompass. What do you know about it, Jesse?
Well, I know they were going to provide some specific rules for some of the larger creatures and monsters in the Warhammer world. Both some specifically named ones, like from Warhammer Fantasy Battles, but also to provide you some generic rules that you can socket onto existing creatures to bring them to a kind of epic level status.
Yeah, that's what I understand too. So what it says here is that you've got two different types of epic antagonists. I guess you have your epic villains and your epic monsters. And from what I understand is there's actually going to be party sheet-like items or devices in it that are going to allow you to socket your creature cards onto these to create epic level monsters. And I think that sounds fantastic. What do you think about it, Jordan?
Yeah, no, I was not really expecting them to go that direction with it. You know, I figured that we'd get new monster cards with bigger, beefier stats or something, but I didn't really expect that they would kind of go and come up with this new mechanic to take existing creatures and then just kind of add more stuff to them to make them bigger and badder. I'm actually interested to see exactly, you know, what kinds of templates they come up with and throw them at my players.
Mm-hmm. I actually prefer what they're talking about here. Like you, I was quite surprised by that approach. But I like the idea that instead of you just getting, say, 6 or maybe even 10 or 20 new monsters that are really strong, I like the ability to go back and utilize everything that you've already collected and, you know, increase its abilities. I'm really curious to see how they actually do it because, I mean, that could be a real big miss if it's not done right.
They had mentioned something to the effect of a socketing it, or rather you socket the creature card onto another card, and it gives it appropriate buffs to the various statistics and probably a couple special abilities.
Yeah, it says apparently they're called epic threat sheets, and they allow a GM to quickly adapt many of the creatures and NPCs from the previous expansions and core sets.
They even talked about a couple specific ones like Galrock, the two-headed Zinch dragon, the Chaos dragon.
Oh, and Archaon, too.
Yeah, Archaon gets his stats, yeah. There was even a few others, like I think one of the orc war bosses, Wyverns, gets some stats, which is probably the one that's in the art where you see the orc war boss flying over the...
Grimgore, Iron. Yeah, Grimgore, mm-hmm. Iron.
Yeah, Grimgore.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Grimgore.
He's pretty badass.
And I mean, these are like immortal characters. And I don't mean that in the sense that they're actually immortal, but more in the sense that these are characters that have been in Warhammer lore for quite some time and are really not meant to be killed per se, but they, you know, you do have the opportunity to fight them and stats for them to fight back. And, you know, these are like epic level campaign level, you know, bosses or adversaries.
Yeah. You're going to have played a lot for your character to, be able to survive encounters with epic antagonists.
Well, other news we have, a lot of you have probably stumbled across it. And if you're still listening to the podcast, you've already solved the issue, hopefully. But the we have transitioned from a from our old server to a new server, and also done some back-end maintenance where we altered ownership of the podcast and things like that to provide a little bit of a different structure for maintaining it going forward. But ultimately, what that all means to you guys, the listeners, is that the RSS feed had to change, and because of that, iTunes has required us to start effectively a new podcast. Now, we still have all the same content from the old one. It just means there's a new podcast page. So for the very short period in time right now, there's going to be actually two instances of the Reckless Dice podcast on iTunes. The original one, which has all episodes up to number 19. And then the current one, which we're using now, which has all episodes up to this one, which is 23 and beyond. So anybody who only sees up to episode 19 in your RSS feed on iTunes or wherever you're looking, you do need to update. And that's either available through iTunes or through the right-hand navigation of the Reckless Dice webpage under feeds. There's about five options there, which you can click on. Any of those will allow you access to the current feed with all current podcasts.
Sweet.
So I apologize for the inconvenience. We've been posting it as often as we can, trying not to be annoying about it. But, you know, we've been up on Facebook, Twitter, and responding directly to messages that you guys have been sending us. So we do appreciate it. And then one last call for help regarding that, because we've been forced to start a new, effectively a new podcast feed. In iTunes eyes, we've lost all comments and all ratings that we'd received to date. So a nice plea to help from our listeners. If you guys enjoy the show, please do show your support by rating the podcast and give us a comment. We'd greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, it's all about community for sure.
And that's all I have to say about that.
Sweet. That was a good plug. Well done. I think
we can plug ourselves and coyly ask for help.
Yeah, I think that dispels all the concerns now that you've fixed that.
Yeah, well, iTunes was not nearly as helpful as I really would have hoped they would be. I worked for
really?
Quite a while. Well, I'm not a huge Apple guy. The iPhone's the only thing I really use. And I kind of had the expectation that their customer service would be pretty smart and helpful. I was pretty sorely let down in that regard, though.
Shoot. Oh, well. So what's this about Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay turning 25?
I heard through the rumor mill that in November, Roleplay turns 25. I don't have a specific date, but somewhere out there, we can all celebrate 25 years of awesome roleplaying.
Yeah, it's one of the longest going, like, continual settings. I mean, D&D goes through lots and lots of settings, or there's many settings, you know.
The way it was worded when I heard it was that it's the longest continually sold franchise, fantasy franchise. So yeah. Meaning it didn't take like a 10-year break and then start up again, which kind of like how D&D did to a degree. Warhammer has consistently sold since its conception.
Yeah, it's a pretty awesome setting. I really dig it.
My favorite for sure.
I was just thinking on my way home today from work. And I was like, you know, okay, well, you know, what would happen if Warhammer just finished and went away? You know, would I become one of those grisly old beardy gamers who is stuck in that one game that I love for the rest of my life that's no longer being made for the next, like, 30 years?
Hey, I resemble that remark.
Yeah. Right. Well, right. That's kind of where I'm going with it.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, maybe. But then I'm also thinking, well, you know, what if, you know, do I have the energy to make this level of dedication to jump ship and learn something new? I'm not sure I do.
Yeah. It's just so in depth. There's so many different ways you can go with a Warhammer campaign or a Warhammer just in the setting in general. It's amazing.
What got me thinking, like, if Warhammer went away, would I still do fantasy gaming?
Yeah.
Well, would anything else ever live up to what Warhammer has given me? I don't know.
Or would you just be forever disappointed by every attempt? Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, kind of Warhammer was where I fled to when I grew disappointed with D&D. So if Warhammer went away, I don't know. I think I'd curl up in a corner somewhere and start weeping.
I mean, like, I'd be forced to learn. Like, if I went jump to D&D, I'd be forced to learn all that lore and be like, this is so boring. Oh, my God. Who are all these gods I don't care about?
Yeah, totally. It's, I don't know. D&D is a whole nother can of worms. But I was thinking about what we were talking about a few episodes back about, like, gaming aids and how, you know, how Warhammer, the new edition of it really utilizes that with all the little bits and, you know, stand-ups and stuff like that. And I was doing some research and I came across a website called Campaign Coins. And it's, it's fantastic, man.
One of the my local shops had something similar to that available in store, but you know,
the design's really sweet. We should just put up a link in the show notes for the place so people can go look at it. But it's an Australian company and they basically mint or print their own like real metal coins for role playing. You know, I think that would really add depth to. Well, at least to new players, you could really get them into a game by actually handing them coins. And it's a much more, I think it's a better way of keeping track of how much money they have as opposed to doing it on paper.
Right. Actually, and it's interesting that you bring that up because after I'm between game sessions with my current ongoing group right now. And one of my players, the last email that he sent to me last week, he said that he had just picked up a whole big bundle of the campaign coins. And he was asking if we wanted to try using them in our game and see how they worked out. So I'll have to get back with you guys. I'll let you know. I'm totally excited about it because, again, it's just kind of another tangible thing, right? It's another thing that the players can use to kind of immerse themselves in their money, right?
Oh, yeah. I think
personal.
Well, I think it would really add a level of depth to the whole experience because I was just kind of like fantasizing about different things that could happen in a game or at least, you know, thinking about them as a game master. I kind of try to do that, think ahead, you know, and I thought that the role playing that you could get out of a group of people by handing them a little treasure chest full of actual coins and then they have to decide how they divvy them up between one another. That could take, I don't know, that could go in a really good way. I think a lot of good things could come from that.
And they're kind of expensive though, right?
Well, it's Australian money and you get them in packs of 10, I think, but they're currently trying to print they have some sort of treasure chest or something like that it's called. And it's like a bundle.
Kind of like a beefy like starter set.
Yeah. It's like a bundle, you know, like the core set for Warhammer or whatever.
You and I were talking about this the other week and we started, you know, we both loved the idea of the authentic ones cause they're so awesome. But we also were thinking, well, you know, not everybody's quite that diehard.
It's true.
And we started talking about some alternatives and you know, we actually came up with quite a few, some of which are very cost effective as well.
Yeah.
You know, for any country that has at least a gold-ish color coin, you could always just use real money.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
in the U.S.,
really,
you could easily use your pennies and
that's really expensive too.
But I mean, for $10 worth of coins, you could have just about everything you need.
Yeah,
but that goldish coin is really the one that'll kind of tip it over.
That's
but alternatively, Lester, you had a couple of great ideas, which kind of centered around using something like buttons.
Oh yeah, I guess you can use all sorts of stuff.
That was actually kind of. You know, I'm not talking like the little plastic buttons, but they even have little metal buttons that have all the different colors that would work really, really well.
Yeah, but I like that idea. I like that's one thing I really like about just this edition in particular is how hands-on it is, how it is meant to be right in front of your face. So you know, there's not so much looking on your sheet for a long time, I guess.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. That's why I'm kind of interested to see. I'm hoping that the campaign coins work out well because I know my players tend to spend their money all over the place, and so I think to actually have them hand me their coins as they spend them, I think that'll create an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, it'll make them think twice about what they're doing with their money.
Yeah, they'll stop buying so much beer.
Yeah, yeah. They won't invest in play coins for their games of chance.
I think that tangible aspect of just tossing coins around, I mean, that sounds fantastic to me. I've never done it. Yeah. And ever since I saw those coins in the store, I was like, that sounds like such a fun idea. Because yeah. I started using those item cards as well. So
yeah,
everything in your inventory has a tangible piece as well. So really, everything your character is holding, you can actually manipulate and move around. And so, you really there is a very interesting psychological effect when you have those in your hand that you actually feel like you're walking around with a ton of crap,
and you,
you feel like you've left, or you can leave some stuff back at the inn.
Yeah,
and the you feel like you're running light. There's this funny immersion factor that totally works.
Instead of like gazing down on a piece of paper and being like, "Oh, I wrote rope on this piece of paper," it's like I have this other piece of paper that tells me that I have a rope. I don't know. It works.
Right, and like Jordan, how often do you like you forget 90% of what's in your inventory?
Yeah.
Yeah, it happens all the time. And then, you know, you get 30 minutes into a game or after a decision point, and you're like, man, I really wish I had a rope. And then somebody says, oh, wait, I did have a rope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did that in our last game. Someone's like, actually, one of the sessions we're going to be posting soon, we're in this huge battle and we're totally losing. And the whole party almost gets killed. And right as the battle's starting to turn in our favor, one of the guys looks at the other and says, don't you still have that gun? He's like, oh, wait, I do. And he pulls out his gun. And then we wipe the floor with everybody after that.
It's just like D&D when the wizard forgets that he has his familiar. And then one round, he's like, oh, yeah, my familiar.
Yeah. And then the combat takes twice as long. Yeah. But what do you think the likelihood is that Fantasy Flight Games will release something similar to the item cards?
I'm thinking that's probably not likely. As much as I'd love to see it, for some reason, I don't know. I mean, they do so many component type things, but I think that kind of like standalone supplement hasn't that kind of gaming aid supplement style. I have not seen at all yet for fantasy roleplay.
Yeah.
And I'd love to see it, but I'm not sure we're gonna. Yeah. I'm not sure it can be as inclusive as we'd really want it to be. It kind of that kind of thing really needs to be a specialty purchase.
Yeah, and
like the what's it, the Paizo cards?
Yeah, well, Paizo, the game mastery cards.
The game mastery cards.
Yeah, Paizo's really got the market kind of cornered on that. I mean, they've really done. They've got a lot of stuff out there now.
Mm-hmm.
If they've really developed that line, it's one line that I haven't actually gotten into, but after, you know, hearing you talking about it in the previous episodes about how you've incorporated that, I actually want to do it. I want to go out and get myself a pack of item cards.
Oh yeah, I love the idea of that. They have it's kind of strange the way they do it. They release them in booster packs and stuff like that too, but you can get like, you know,
I bought the starter set and then two of their kind of like more specific supplements.
Mm-hmm. Like the magic one and stuff like that, items.
Yeah, they had like an adventuring pack one and an adventuring pack two, and then like alchemy items or something to that effect. And I would very much suggest the adventure packs. Everything beyond that seemed a little bit too specific.
Yeah.
But, you know, for anybody looking to get started, you can do it for under 20 bucks.
Yeah, they seem like they would really add to the game. Especially, I mean, they just fit so well with the way Warhammer 3rd is, you know?
Yeah.
All right, well, let's take a quick break. And when we get back, we're going to talk about abstract movement. And we're back. And today, as our focus point, we're going to talk about abstract movement and different ways you can really fudge the rules, get into different ways of using it, or kind of homebrew something that really suits your play style, whether you're using things like maps, little tokens, the rules as written. So, Lester, tell us a little bit of what you have planned here.
Okay, well, basically, the way that you use movement in most role-playing games, at least most role-playing games that I'm familiar with, they tend to use a 5-foot step or battle grids, so a squared off map. And that's not the way that Warhammer 3rd approaches that. What they do is they use a distance an abstract distance kind of system. And you have several different categories, I guess, or zones. You have engaged, which is basically you're sitting next to a person or standing next to a person, and you can reach out and physically touch them or grapple with them. And then you have close range, medium range, long range, and extreme range. And these all are all represented by the amount, well, to move between these ranges costs you a certain amount of maneuvers. And the way that the fatigue system works is you can actually move from engaged to long range, but it would, you know, you would tire your character out, but it is possible. And I know that a lot of people are kind of, they kind of don't understand or don't like, for whatever reason, the way that these rules are written. So I kind of thought we should almost discuss some alternatives. And I know that Jordan has quite a bit of experience in this particular field, because he, I watched a video that he put up on YouTube discussing this, just in any kind of role-playing game situation. And I was curious to know, how do you interpret the rules as written? And what are some possible things that you would do to change the way that those are represented in your games?
Well, so it's actually been, even from the beginning of this current group that I'm running Warhammer for, it's actually the very first session, it created some points of contention, just because, you know, in understanding how the rules work and how people who might be more used to a very traditional 5-foot, you know, grid type of system of, mm-hmm. it's not as precise. And so the other thing to remember, which I'll kind of back into here in a minute, is that one of the other things that's very abstract about Warhammer 3rd is that they don't specifically tell you how long a combat round is either. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in games like Dungeons and Dragons, they tell you specifically, you know, a combat round is 6 seconds, and in 6 seconds, a character can move, you know, 30 feet, and that's it. Those are set in stone. And so most people are kind of, you know, they come up on role-playing games where movement and timing is very specifically laid out like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so people get this expectation that, well, you know, every 6 seconds I should be, you know, this is how much is happening in the course of a round, and this is how far somebody should be able to go, or, you know, this is what is reasonable to expect from somebody moving around. Mm-hmm. And Warhammer, not only, you know, again, not only is it abstract in the sense that it doesn't tell you that a round is 6 seconds or 10 seconds or 30 seconds, but it also, you know, tells you that you're not moving 30 feet or 40 feet or 50 feet. You're just moving between relative distances.
Yeah.
And so it created one of my players. He was playing a character that was primarily, he wasn't much of a combatant character. I think he was, his career was envoy. So he was pretty vulnerable. You know, he didn't want to get up in people's faces and swing a sword. So his primary weapon was a bow. So what he would usually do in combat situations is he would go, you know, he would try and get as far away as possible while still, you know, within reach of his weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he would, you know, plink arrows into the combat. The very first thing that we noticed, so I'll just kind of hit this right on the nose, was that with the fatigue rules, and, you know, you can spend fatigue to move additional, you know, additional maneuvers. So you could, like you said, move from close range to long range in a single round. And what this one player pointed out was that, well, for one, it was kind of a surprise. Like he didn't really know, and I probably didn't explain beforehand that this was possible within the game, right?
Yeah.
But there was like this melee going on, and he was at long range from one of the enemies and, you know, firing his bow. And then, you know, I said, okay, well, the enemies are not going to just sit there and get peppered with arrows. They're going to go take care of this guy. And so one of them rushed him, and in one round, you know, he basically went all the way from, he took a lot of fatigue, sure, but, yeah. But in one round he moved from, you know, over here all the way over to the archer and could attack him. And so he stepped back, you know, he said, hey, whoa, what's going on here? I thought, you know, I thought I was like 100 yards away. How did this guy all of a sudden get up in my face? And so, it started kind of a series of looking deeper into how those movement mechanics worked and how we wanted to apply our own kind of ideas about, you know, how how far should a character realistically be able to move, irregardless of, you know, spending a bazillion fatigue, right?
It sounds like you're hitting on kind of that core concept or core difference between what D&D and Warhammer offer, where D&D is essentially a set of rules and guidelines that you play within, and you're not allowed to push the boundaries of interpretation,
right?
Where Warhammer is meant to be taken at a little bit higher level. There is no granularity in the way the rules work.
Well, D&D is a tactical combat game about delving through dungeons and slaying monsters, whereas Warhammer is actually a role-playing game set in a very rich setting.
So that role-playingness or that abstractness that it applies is really you have to kind of come up with the role-playing reason for the storytelling reason, not the rules reason, on why something like that might not be applicable. Yeah. Maybe the GM should say, well, you know, long range doesn't really seem practical for this dude sprinting across a field, but, you know, maybe he can make it most of the way there, or, you know, that.
But to close long range would like collapse your regular minion character. Couldn't do that because they take wounds instead of fatigue, and to go from engaged to long range takes.
But if we're talking strictly
moments.
If we're talking strictly rules perspective,
yeah,
it's, you know, that even a goblin or something. I mean, yeah, it's going to hurt him, but he's going to make it into base to base, and he's going to get a swing.
Right.
I mean, he's still going to get an attack. Yeah. Which is
does a goblin have, like, a goblin minion has more than 5 wounds?
Well, maybe a goblin's not a good example, but I think a goblin has something like 8 to 10.
Oh,
so,
really?
You know, there's very few creatures that have only, you know, 5 or 6 wounds, but, you know, someone will correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure.
Well,
but
if they're minions, they only have their toughness for their wounds, so.
Oh, okay. Oh, you mean like a henchman?
So I'm sure, little henchmen or minions would die before they could close that. Because I believe to go from engaged to close is 1 movement, from close to medium is 2, and then from medium to long is 3. So that you'd have to take 6 fatigue, meaning your guy would sprint really fast, but then he'd also be useless in combat because he'd be taking a whole bunch of penalties to any attack he tried to make.
I think things like house rules really become applicable when you start. I mean, the movement rules are great. They work just fine when it's that kind of close to medium range stuff. And once you start incorporating the moving from close to long or close to extreme type stuff, that's where it really starts to break down, and you need a GM intervention on what's practical or not, because it really just gets a little wonky at that point if you're still trying to kind of shoehorn in what you want your character to do just because the rules allow it, not because you actually should be able to do it.
Right. Well, and the other thing that we've discovered, and the other source of me reaching out for ways to kind of house rule the system, or, you know, come up with alternate ways to make it easier and more intuitive to track movement and combat, especially when you're talking about larger groups, right? When you're talking about four party members and, you know, 5 or 6 NPCs and you're, you know, the abstract rules as written in the raw kind of start to break down when characters start to kind of move in different directions. You know, when you've got guys who are on the north side of the road, and then you've got guys that are on the south side, and then you've got guys running east and guys running west, and then who's how far away from, you know, each of these 4 different groups, it can become a mess if you're not careful about it.
Yeah, I think you'd almost have to make a centralized point at that, you know, in that instance. There'd have to be landmarks that you would measure from.
And actually, that was kind of it was a very early stage of me just internalizing thoughts on how to, you know, create a nice template for this format of you know, how to track things that are all off in different directions. And I started, interestingly enough, I started off with basically like a bullseye, like, you know, like a central circular area that marked this is the center of the encounter. And then there's a band outside of that that's close range. And then there's a band outside of that that's medium range and long range. And so I started with that, but it kind of it's okay. And it's actually a decent way if you want to track combat just based on a particular pinpoint location. Mm-hmm. you know, like a location card or something, you know, if you put the ruins down in the middle of the table and then just have kind of bands of distance that spread out from it.
Yeah, that would work really well, I think.
That's actually not that unlike the using the band system is actually does deviate a bit from the rules as written, but right. I've actually found the rules as written work to some degree if you build a kind of like you said with your bands, but the if you actually build a map effectively of where everything is located. So, you know, you may have like the main encounter in the center, and then, you know, let's say it's a, you know, a clearing, and then you've got, you know, the road is off to the right at medium distance. So you throw down two tokens to represent your distance to the road, and you throw the location card down there, and you start creating almost like a little tree structure of location cards and tokens with a certain number of chits in between each one to kind of build out where somebody could travel.
Right.
And then if somebody travels off of your tree for some reason, you just kind of add a branch by throwing on a couple more chits in between them. And you do effectively, by doing that, create a little bit of a battle map. Mm-hmm. But the I think even by going that route, you are overcomplicating the kind of the rules as written for as far as movement is kind of intended to go. Uh-huh. But I find myself being a little uncomfortable with abstracting it to the degree that the book suggests.
Right.
I kind of like, I mean, I really love, I'm a big map guy. I love visuals. I love maps. Mm-hmm. So eliminating maps from my combat and encounters is kind of painful. So I kind of like still include something if I can.
Right.
So even to the degree of actually, I went and bought those, the D&D map tile, starter sets, and I've yet to use them, but I'm looking forward to doing it this weekend. And I want to see how those go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're supposed to be pretty sweet.
Yeah. And one of the things, for folks that do want to use or that have those kinds of the D&D maps that might, or, you know, or if they have their dry erase, 5-foot grid maps, right? And they want to use those in the game. One of the ways that I've seen, heard, and contemplated about handling the movement is to, you know, of course, on those maps, you could still use each square representing 5 feet, right? But then you just kind of you can do a mental conversion to say that every maneuver your character can move 30 feet or 20 feet or whatever it is, right?
Yeah, that's what we've been using when we did our map tools.
Yeah, right.
So I think we did a very similar conversion to that, and that made a lot of sense.
Yeah, and so if you've got that way, you don't have to throw away the maps that you already have, right? You can still use them, and you just
handle that fatigue though? Because wouldn't the same problem arise where somebody can move, you know, 120 feet? If you're using rules, like what you have to put almost like a cap on it.
Yeah, I think from a practical perspective, you have to put a cap on it.
Yeah, well, a character can only move like 120 feet.
Yeah, and that encounter that I was talking about before, that actually resulted in kind of the first element of the house rules that I use in my games for movement, in that and this was especially solidified when Omens of War came out and they introduced the mount rules. So, you know, that mounts give you an extra movement maneuver and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so the advantage of having a mount, right, is that you can move faster than everybody else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Never have footmen engage cavalry because they'll just get trampled. But
unless they got spears.
Well, yeah. But your footmen can never outrun the cavalry, right?
Never
withdraw from cavalry.
But you can overrun.
Yeah. But one of the first things that I addressed with my house rules when this came up was that I said, okay, well, you're probably hitting on a good point. It's probably unrealistic for, you know, it was a beast man. I think it was an Ungor to just completely move from, you know, way, way, way over here where you're just barely in range with your bow to all of a sudden, you know, being up in your face and hitting you with his club. And so we basically just said that we house ruled that characters could move from one range increment to the next, but they can't cross more than one range increment on foot unless, of course, they're mounted or they're a creature that has, mm-hmm, the swift trait, in which case they get extra movement so they can move even faster and they could go from close to long range. But generally we said that characters could only go from close to medium or medium to long or long to extreme, but they couldn't go more than one at a time.
Yeah, I think I would almost put a cap on how much fatigue or how many maneuvers they could take, like three maybe.
Right. Yeah, you could do something like that too. And that was just again, just a way to kind of maybe bring a little bit of our own kind of logic to it, right? That's just one way to approach it.
Excellent. Well, I kind of like the idea that there is a lot of different ways that you can approach it, and that's really, I know you guys are probably bored to death of us saying that over and over again, but that's really the beauty of the system, in that you can approach so many of the rules concepts from different ways and modify them to suit your play style without really even breaking the core functionality of the game.
Because it's so abstract.
You can drop components, you can add components, you can modify them slightly, and really it's all, the best part of the system, of course, is the dice mechanic, but everything else outside of that is easily adjusted. But just to throw my two cents into the throwing a cap on using fatigue, one of the things that I've started using is that a player can't burn more than two fatigue when attempting to do that. So generally speaking, that's going to allow somebody to, disengage and move an increment or rush somebody if they need to, but it's going to prevent somebody from, covering the football field when they need to, when they're trying to engage somebody.
Fair enough.
All right, so when we get back, we're going to dive into a little bit of a primer on the elves.
And welcome back. We're going to talk about elves a little bit. I know that a lot of people on the forums have been discussing or hoping for an elf supplement. I hope they make one. That would be really awesome. I think that the elves are an interesting portion. They're definitely not my favorite, but they are very varied, I should say. So I just want to basically do a really brief breakdown of the elves and what they mean to the world of Warhammer. So the elves were created by the Old Ones. They were the second race to be created by the Old Ones following the Lizard Men. And they were created to be able to manipulate the winds of magic. And they basically lived a really great life exploring the world for a long time. And then chaos started to incur. There was a massive collapse on the poles of the world of Warhammer that caused chaos energy to leak into the world, creating all sorts of evil demons and mutants and things like that. The Beastmen came out of this first incursion of chaos, and the elves played the most pivotal role in battling that. And in fact, the only reason that the world of Warhammer even exists today is and isn't completely overrun by chaos is because of the sacrifice of two elves. One of them, his name is Anarion, and he is the first Phoenix King of the elves, and he basically withdrew the Sword of Cain from its eternal resting place and used it to defeat these demons in mortal combat. And then there was a wizard, and I believe his name was Kaldor, or it's something like that. And he got together all the other mages, and the elves are the greatest manipulators of magic in the old world next to the Slann. And they basically created a vortex on the island of Ulthuan, which is the home isle of the elves. And that sucks in all the chaos energy from these rifts in reality at the poles. And that's the only reason that the world of Warhammer can exist the way that it does. And following this, there was a very long period where the elves, they basically explored the world and created a massive civilization that spanned the entire world.
Which is why you'll see like elven ruins and stuff throughout the empire.
Yeah, precisely. And they had a very good relationship with the dwarves. They actually were trading partners, and they had fought together in these incursions versus chaos. And then something happened where a war happened between the dwarves and the elves. And the elves know it as the War of the Beard, and the dwarves know it as the War of Vengeance. And then what happened here is the dwarves ended up defeating the elves in this war, and that caused contention between the two races. And the war was started because what had happened on the island of Ulthuan is the elves had begun to bicker, and they basically split into two factions because one of the princes of the elves, his name was Malekith. He fancied himself as the king, and he played some skullduggerish tricks on the elves, and he
would have been a daunting check, I think.
Yeah, a very daunting check. But he basically poisoned the then Phoenix King to try to become the king himself. And there's a ritual that the elves do where they have to cross through this archway, basically, the shrine of Assyrian. They have to pass through these flames, and only the rightful Phoenix King can pass through the flames. Otherwise, they're left hideously scarred. And of course, Malekith, being the rat bastard that he is, stepped through these flames and was scarred for life. And then half of the elves believed that he was the true king, and the other half believed that he wasn't, and they battled each other. And Malekith started to lose, and they retreated to a place called Naggaroth, which is essentially like Canada. It's a cold and dark place with mountains and forests.
A bunch of pale people up there.
Yeah, a bunch of pale, sadistic people up here. Anyway, they fled there, and there's been an eternal war between them since that point in time. It's a constant civil war between the High Elves and the now Dark Elves, who are sadistic, and they like to capture slaves, and they're all into torture and stuff like that.
So where do the Wood Elves fit into the that scenario?
Well, basically, Malekith sent some spies, essentially, to cause some chaos between the dwarves and the elves. And he had his elves, his dark elves, masquerade as high elves, and they ambushed dwarven caravans and were killing dwarves, which led to this war between the two. And after that war happened and the dwarves won, they essentially killed the Phoenix King and sent the elves packing. The elves started to leave. They started a great exodus from the old world, which is basically where Tilia and Empire and all that are. They started to flee back to Ulthuan, and there were certain elves who had lived in the forest, and they had no connection to Ulthuan because they weren't born there. And they felt that the new forests, particularly Athel Lorn, were their place. They were basically their home. So they stayed. They did not go with elves, which created contention between the High Elves and the Wood Elves. And the Wood Elves basically just are insular, and they live in their forests and protect their forests.
It's important to note that the Wood Elves and the High Elves are not enemies per se.
No.
But the Wood Elves are very much a neutral race in that they are, and anybody who threatens their homeland is an enemy. Their introverted nature really essentially means they don't go out looking for fights necessarily. Mm-hmm. They have been known to leave the forest, but primarily they kind of keep to their own and maintain very, very limited ties to any other culture.
They're very much like nature, in the sense that, I mean, nature doesn't care. If you're not prepared, you know, you're going to die in a forest. If you're not prepared, it's very neutral. Good and evil are kind of, they're kind of gray area for the Wood Elves. But that's a very quick primer on elves, and I'm hoping that they come up with an elf supplement. And if they do, Jordan, I'm curious to know, what do you think the structure of a supplement like that would be? How do you think they'd go about doing that?
Well, I mean, hopefully, because we have these three different races of elves, right? And they're kind of interesting. I mean, the humans, yeah, they have their the different areas of the regions of the empire, and then you also have humans from other countries, right? Like Tilia and Astalia. But mm-hmm. humans are just humans, right? And they, but the elves, they all have very different cultures. They all have very different outlooks. They, and even in the game, in the third edition of the game, they have, entirely different careers, right? Like the mm-hmm. high elves have their specific careers, their sword masters and whatnot, and the wood elves have their own careers. So ideally, we would get something on all of the elves, and I don't think that we would get anything exhaustive on any of them, but at least kind of more dabbling into each of the elves.
Mm-hmm. Give them more options.
Right, right. Actually, and just kind of to throw out some numbers there, I've been putting together a spreadsheet for character creation, rolling up careers in Warhammer 3. And of course, now with all of the expansions that have been released, there's something like 52 total basic careers now. And while the humans, I think 45 of the 52 are human applicable, and like 40 of them are dwarf applicable. Only 20 of them are available to high elves, and only 16 are available to wood elves.
Yeah,
so I'd kind of like to see more careers. I'm hoping that we'd get a lot more expansion on optional or options for careers for those characters, but also, specific actions that speak to those specific, their specific cultures, their specific combat styles.
Yeah, I agree for sure. Jesse, how do you think? What would you do if you were to put together an elf supplement? Just the basic structure.
Well, I think you're going to include. I mean, given that the high elves and the wood elves are playable races, dark elves are a non-playable race, that potentially gives you a nice, kind of their duo setup. So you could probably include an adventure packet and booklet for a high elf and dark elf confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
And for the adventure, so you have kind of like your Lieber Dark Elficus, and then you've got your Lieber High Elficus, and then the high elf book may, I think ideally, I don't know if ideally, but I think realistically, having the high elves and the wood elves as the good guys in one of those books, I could kind of see it going both ways. I could see it either including both elven races and then the evil race, or I could see the wood elves not being part of that supplement. I could see the high elves and dark elves being paired together.
That seems very natural.
Yeah. The wood elves maybe get included, maybe not. If they don't get included, I see them getting tied with something like Bretonnia or Beastmen or something like that. But
Beastmen is what I see. Yeah.
I see it coming out as a supplement very similar to the way that we saw the Dwarven supplement recently.
Yeah, with a it kind of talks about goblins in the other one. It doesn't focus
Right, well, but it does give you a lot of goblin creatures and does talk about some of their culture and the wars against them.
And the adventure is centered around goblins and orcs.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Yeah, well, and pairing the wood elves with Bretonnia would kind of make sense.
Yeah, or beastmen, because beastmen are their eternal enemies, so.
Well, right, right. Yeah, that's true, too. And, of course, Athelorn is actually technically in Bretonnia.
Precisely. Yeah. I would love to
That'll be interesting to see one of the other human races actually get a real content book.
I think that is going to come in Heroes Call, though. I think Bretonnia will be one of the options for.
Do you think Bretonnia will be? I'm pretty confident all the other provinces within the Empire will be.
Well,
but
how many
Bretonnia
were there?
Still is a question mark.
How many did they say there were going to be?
I think it was 9.
And there's already the Reichlanders.
Yeah. Well, didn't they say too that it was? They said 9, but didn't they say humans and dwarfs?
Yeah.
So it might not be 9, all 9 of the, or however.
Yeah, I'm expecting at least 2 more dwarven ones. So you can be like a Karak, Asgal, Karak, Karak, I can't even say it anymore.
Karak.
Thank you.
Yeah, my dwarf players have trouble with that all the time.
If it's not in front of me, that's a tough one to say. All right, well, we're going to cut off the elf discussion there and hop into a little bit of Q&A. So when we get back, we've got some great questions and comments and some great gaming tips from the community and our listeners. As always, you can submit your questions and comments to recklessdice@gmail.com, on our Facebook page under Reckless Dice, or hit us up on Twitter at Reckless Dice. Conrad Klodgebor, and I'm butchering that, I'm sorry. Anybody else have an attempt at that?
Kjellbor? Klodgebor? No.
I'm gonna hope that L's silent. Klodgebor.
Klodgebor? Yeah.
I think he's from Northern Europe.
Yeah,
I think that's a good guess.
He says, "Hi, I remember that there was a distance meter tool on the online map, the Schmottwow. I see that it has changed. Why? Do you plan to reestablish the distance meters?" So, for those of you who have seen it, I decided to opt out of the kind of Google Maps display style for the super huge detailed map of the Warhammer Old World. And the reason I did that was I found a tool that allowed me to get very similar functionality as far as, you know, having a very, very large image file and being able to zoom in fluidly and look around and have fun with it using Silverlight. And the only downfall, the performance increase is tremendous.
Oh, yeah.
And it's smooth, it's sexy, it loads quicker. The downfall is kind of twofold. I do not get to incorporate any of the custom coding that we had done in the earlier versions to leverage things like plotting a course and measuring. But the benefits of this, in my mind, far outweighed the detriments, mostly because I'm able to maintain this on my own now instead of being forced to use other community members. Jacob McQuaid, you are the man still. It became a little prohibitive for me to make reoccurring updates to the map, and especially in a timely manner. So with this new method, I have full control of it and can actually maintain it over the long term much better and much quicker. So sorry for losing that one functionality, but hopefully the benefits of you guys being able to play with it more and have better timely updates are going to be the result of it.
Oh, and it's... Go ahead.
I'll go Conrad's pain, because that was actually, you know, in my current campaign, that was one of the coolest things that...
Oh, yeah, I loved it.
My player characters are currently going from Nuln to Altdorf, and it was nice to kind of tell them exactly how many days of rain they were going to have to endure.
Well, I'm not sure if I really want to admit this, but I will anyway. You know, through the different iterations of the map, and as it's expanded and grown, and the different variations of each map's measuring based on who drew it and when, and all the different maps that came together, the actual measuring distances were really pretty shot in the dark. I mean, they all sounded good because we could give you very specific numbers, but they weren't really that accurate. And in particular, the accuracy got thrown way out of whack in the most recent iteration. When I updated it to include the Badlands and Araby and the Darklands, because I actually had to downsize the quality of the map or the resolution of the map slightly in order to accommodate the maximum size of a JPEG file.
Right.
So what was supposed to be 45,000 pixels wide had to be reduced to 30,000 pixels wide. So, you know, I don't know what that's what, like 20% or so. The maximum resolution was reduced by that much. And that effect had rippled out into the code, so that the code was no longer, the measuring code was no longer synced with the size of the map as it was before. So when that downsampling happened, the measuring tool effectively became broken, only in that it was measuring inaccurate distances at that point. So all the distances were up to 20% off.
Right.
So it was kind of like, well, I don't know how to fix this thing because it was built so complexly at the beginning that I can't maintain it going forward, nor do I know how to fix it. So I'm sorry, I'm just unplugging it.
I like the functionality, though. I really like how you can just zoom fast and you can go all over the place.
And the new map offers a very, very easy full screen mode. In the bottom right, you just tap a button, goes full screen immediately. So it allowed me to eliminate a page on my site. And also, I don't have to store what was essentially 4.5 gigs worth of image tiles to make that map.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, the new map is shiny. I like it.
Yeah, so I'm sorry, but I'm not. So Lori, Mayala. I'm butchering the names. I have so much trouble with his name.
Yep.
Mayala, who is he's the mountain. He was a friend of the show, or yep, still is. He commented that he thinks we should add the new Red Riding Hood to our list of Warhammer-inspired movies. And he said he's been meaning to watch it, but he has anybody else seen that one?
No.
I have.
I haven't seen it, no.
There's parts of it that I think are Warhammer-esque or Warhammer-inspired. Certainly the... if you want to go along the witch route, or if you want to kind of get inspired on somebody in the town as the bad guy, but everybody looks like they're the bad guy type of thing, mm-hmm, which is very common in Warhammer now, especially as the stories are created. I think it's got a couple of things you could go with there. It's a good twist on the, you know, the Red Riding Hood story, but, you know, the movie itself is only average, not great. All right, and here's a little bit of a long one, but I think a fun one to this is a gaming tip. It's a fun one that I think has enough value, and I think everybody will either get inspired by it or even follow the tools and suggestions he provides. So this is from Remoraz, and he emails in, here are some great GM tools. I use my iPhone quite a bit, and I've tried out a lot of different apps to help with GMing. One of the most useful I've found is free mind mapping app called Idea Sketch. I use the app to create a visual flowchart index of my play sessions. I have a central point where the party starts, and I tether plot hook entries to the starting area, and then I tether all the NPCs, monsters, and locations to the plot hooks where appropriate. Now there is a space for notes, but I usually just write a brief description of it, whether it's an NPC, monster, or location, and then a page number in the appropriate rulebook, module, or a bestiary if he needs the info. In the end, you're left with a visual index and flowchart for your play sessions that take place in that takes into account your sessions may not unfold in linear fashion. Instead of flipping through books and scanning loads of text for what the innkeeper looks like, you just look at your flowchart notes. If you need a stat block and detailed notes, you can easily look them up because the page number is right there. If the innkeeper is vital to the plot, perhaps it makes his entry a little different color, which tells me I need to do everything I can to get the PCs to help him. Or perhaps I create a floating plot hook that serves the same purpose as the innkeeper called Farmer, who will approach the PCs no matter where they are in town.
Maybe the innkeeper is a complex character who will have a variety of actions based on how the PCs treat him. I can tether his various reactions to his entry, then tether these reactions to the farmer as well, indicating the farmer will have the same responses to the PCs encountered, or as the PCs encountered him instead. I found that just making the chart and showing the associations is enough to help me keep the adventure on track. I no longer need pages and pages of notes because adventure flowcharts was a large part of what I would write down before. I don't have to flip through tons of books and back and forth to find the scrap of info as a page is right there.
Thanks for covering those technical difficulties there.
You're welcome.
So for the too long didn't read version, which we could have given you at the beginning, but we won't, is mind mapping apps are nice for creating adventure flowcharts and indexes.
Yeah, for sure. I have one called Kyra Mind Map, which is a free mind map for my laptop that I create my plot hooks and stuff like that.
See, I've never done one digitally. I've always just kind of written down like location bubbles and, you know, little in a line, kind of like an idea flowchart. Yeah. On paper, but I think the concept's the same.
Well, the Kyra mind map is really sweet because you can have a whole bunch of different clouds of ideas and you can click on them and you can have entire text blocks. So I can write everything that the guy's going to say, you know, all the different PCs in the room. I can do a whole bunch of stuff. So I think they're great.
Yeah, that's cool. It definitely would make it a lot easier. I mean, as a GM, your mind's already all over the place as it is, trying to track, you know, NPCs and making sure that mm-hmm. the PCs are picking up clues and you know, rolling your dice and looking up stats and all that kind of thing. So, unfortunately, I don't have an iPhone myself, but I almost
want to
get one just for this tool, just because then, like he said,
he said it was free, right?
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to go check that out tomorrow.
But you know, yeah, you can have page references right there on your iPhone attached to your notes. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I mean, my more recent method has been to highlight and write all over my books, and which I've actually been enjoying because it, you know, it really just highlights the content you need to focus on. But particularly for the, you know, self-made adventures.
Yeah,
I think that the flowchart thing would be fantastic.
Actually, that had been my primary strategy a lot of the times, especially with you know, pre-written adventure modules and stuff. I'm kind of old school. I'll take a Xerox machine and I'll Xerox copy my adventure, and then I'll just take a highlighter to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just highlight the important parts.
Yeah, well, I've been highlighting the what I'm allowed to read to players and not highlighting what I'm not allowed to read to players, because these books are not particularly good at that. However, I have noticed that in the new books from Lure of Power, they've actually begun a new format of they've been formatting the text slightly differently. I think they've added, I can't remember if it was a slightly blue background in italic, but they have begun to differentiate how some of the text is formatted in an attempt to really establish a better hierarchy of information.
Yeah, that's sweet.
So Steven Zick emails in one of our earlier podcasts, you had suggested order for some of the first adventures to come out. I think it was Gathering Storm, Edge of Night, then Witch's Song. Our GM was wondering. Thanks, Steven. So there is kind of an unofficial order that the adventurers can go in. It's very easy to supplement or swap out anything you like. But do you guys have do you guys want to take a stab at what you think the best order is?
Well, I think I always kind of approached it from the release order, right? I just kind of assumed that what was the preview adventure?
The Day Late and a Shilling Short, think is always – that's the demo adventure.
Yeah, the demo.
And I think that one is – definitely number one.
Right. And then that one kind of seems like it led into, or it could lead into Eye for an Eye.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And then the next one was Gathering Storm, and then Edge mm-hmm. of Night, and then mm-hmm. Witch's Song came after that, right?
Yeah. And I think that is a really good order. You could, the Gathering Storm is probably the only one that's not necessarily necessary in that setup there. It works well, but you could even it has a lot of hooks that could lead into the other ones, but they're not so strong that it needs to be there, because Gathering Storm is actually a huge series of games. I mean, it's the first campaign, and a lot of people, I don't think, give it the credit for the size that it actually is to play it.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're talking at least 10 sessions if you're going to roll through that thing. So that's a serious amount of game time.
Yeah. Well, and I do remember that, Fantasy Flight's apparently been trying to specifically plug hooks into the different adventures, because, of course, Eye for an Eye centers around Lord Aschaffenburg and his manor. And then, the Aschaffenburgs pop up in Edge of Night in Ubersreich.
Well, also the newest adventure from the Lure of Power takes place in Ubersreich as well, which has a lot of hooks into earlier adventures, and that you could easily leverage content from Edge of Night, Witch's Song, and Eye for an Eye.
Yeah, they've really been developing the town of Ubersreich. That's been pretty much their focus.
That's right. Didn't they include like a full map of Ubersreich in the back of the power boat?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mostly full map.
The other adventures we haven't really mentioned then are Omens of War, which I think can very doesn't have a very direct tie.
The Crimson Spear or something like that.
I don't recall if that was the exact adventure name, but it was something to that effect.
Crimson Rain. It's called
Crimson Rain. Thank you.
That's right.
Then we have the Winds of Magic supplement. Which I believe the adventure is called the same thing. And that one can kind of take place. That one's kind of meant to take place in Altdorf, but that's not necessarily required. And then there's the Horror at Hugeldahl, which is the Nurgle supplement. And that one actually takes place very close to Ubersreich. And that one can kind of be inserted in, anywhere along the line, if you like.
Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be for higher level players, though, like people who have reached like rank 2, I think.
So then the only remaining ones, if I'm not mistaken, are the Blackfyre Pass, Journey to Blackfyre Pass, and then the actual Blackfyre Pass adventure itself, Harrow of Thanes. And those two ones are not integrated into the main storyline at all at the moment.
I think that's more of a dwarf one as opposed to a human-centered one.
It is, yeah. So that those are kind of your two alternatives. Now, I do also think that the Journey to Blackfyre Pass is a fantastic introductory adventure if you need something that has more substance than A Day Late and a Shilling Short and actually feels like a full adventure. For maybe somebody who is familiar with role-playing but not to this system, I think that's a much better adventure. While A Day Late and a Shilling Short is good to teach somebody how to role-play. Because that one is much, much shorter and the complexity of the story and the engagement level is much lower.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're going to wrap it up there. I think that is a we've got a few more questions, but I think we'll save those for the next episode. So we'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. Be sure to comment on the site, recklessdice.com, or shoot us an email at recklessdice, or follow us on Twitter or Facebook at recklessdice. And again, a plea for support to comment on our iTunes page or rate it. We'd greatly appreciate it. And until next time, you guys, thanks for listening. And Jordan, thanks so much for joining us.
That was my pleasure. Absolutely.